earth.org. East the Earth is produced by the Catalina Island Conservancy with support from its Fund for a Sustainable Planet, because Earth is an island.
PRN, the Progressive Radio Network, your online destination for important information and commentary on health, public affairs, politics, and the environment.
Please be advised that the views and opinions expressed by Richard Martin, Senior Vice President of Global Strategic Investments, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent those of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments made on the basis of Mr. Martin's comments are entirely unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener or investor.
Richard Martin here with you again for the hourly rendition of Richard Martin's Wake Up Call. Just a quick word, please, about the call-in line. Again, the people have called in saying they're trying to, they've emailed me saying they've tried to call in without success. I'm not really aware of what the problem is, but I must ask you, please, to try to call in with your questions. And if you fail to get through, please email me so that I really have some kind of a handle on how many people are trying to call in, and so that the technician can have a better idea of how many people are failing to get through. So please call in with your questions to 1-888-873-4643. Let me repeat the number once again: 888-873-4643. And thereafter, if you have a problem, please let me know by email, and so we can at least get tabs on the number of people that are trying to get through without success. All right. Ladies and gentlemen, I am now able to tell you, and you are the first people to have heard this from my lips, that I am now certain that the coming depression will be several orders of magnitude worse than the depression of the 1930s. I'm going to give you some information of a vaguely comparative nature here, but I'm not going to wear you down with mountains of statistics. I'm just basically going to give you the basic facts. Statistics come to people who are interested, by way of emails and things like that that I send out. But, it becomes overwhelming if I give you too many numbers. I'm going to give you some numbers, but I'm not going to make this a sort of laboratory of facts and figures. To start with, government services and payments, which include, service sector jobs, public and private debt of all types, and unfunded retiree benefits are going to be liquidated, that is to say, done away with. Okay, the debt was liquidated very much in the same way by the 1929-32 depression, and that kind of debt will have to be liquidated yet again by what is, as I say, liable to be an even greater worldwide depression. My thinking is that current housing prices, I'm talking about current prices, prices where they are today, will have to fall some 75%. And that's just to arrive at the long rate trend line on a technical basis. You know that you can draw trend lines over any given period of time to see where the average rise or fall can be found and how much above or below that line the market is. Well, the market is, as I say, at a point at which a 75% decline would be required to bring it back to that average line. states that rely on income and sales taxes to pay for schools and healthcare and criminal justice, such public services are going to be rapidly and drastically reduced. Municipalities will be sending out blight bills to property owners who fail to maintain their properties, whether they be foreclosed homeowners or banks, savings and loans, or credit unions. Abandoned and blighted buildings are going to be bulldozed, and their lots will be stoned or grassed over. As property values fall, municipalities are going to have to reduce property tax bills, and in some cases write the tax bill to nearly zero in cities such as Detroit and Cleveland, where properties already have negative value. Public education spending, which has been phased on property taxes, can no longer pay the $12,000 to $25,000 per student and the $60,000 teacher salaries. Public education will be drastically reconstituted with superfluous curriculum such as foreign language eliminated, and junior high and senior high students will be spending a large part of their day at home as schools operate on a part-time basis. Municipalities have been promising government workers more in salaries and pension benefits than cannot possibly be met. Unfunded liabilities have been mounting for years. The ticking time bomb is going to go off. Cities are going to be forced into bankruptcy. The first one already has declared bankruptcy. It is Vallejo in California. The bubble of financial service jobs, retail jobs, and food service jobs created by Alan Greenspan created liquidity are going to evaporate. Commercial lending simply will not be available at any cost. The credit crunch will morph to become credit gridlock. Companies lacking liquidity will be shutting down literally overnight in Bear Stearns fashion, declaring bankruptcy and selling any assets for pennies on the dollar. Faced with falling sales and unavailable credit, retailers will abandon leases, and the commercial real sector, already battered by long-gone real estate agents, lawyers, builders, contractors, mortgage brokers, insurance companies, furniture stores, and all the rest, will freeze up, leaving the strip mall and shopping center owners to board up. Condo projects under development and those recently built will go back to the regional and commercial banks as Regions Financial, as would-be investors back out of deals. These will board up the properties in mass before they themselves go into bankruptcy. Gleaming condo towers will stand as tombs to a bygone era. Declining enrollment and soaring costs will force colleges and universities to reduce curriculum offerings and to lay off in mass. Small high schools will shutter and students bus long distances to larger ones. Neighborhoods that have provided student rental housing will turn into sparsely populated bohemian ghettos. REITs that engage in management of student housing communities near university campuses will become awesome ghost towns. An ever-growing portion of credit card debt is going to have to be liquidated, simply written off, as consumers are going to be walking away from that debt. Rising unemployment will send retailers' profits down and down. Dividends will be cut to the bone. More and more banks and retailers will be going into bankruptcy. The next steps for banks will be what is truly required: total liquidation of themselves and the debt that is in their portfolio, writing it all off, and over time this will indeed happen. The number of vacant homes will soar from the current level of 2.9% of U.S. homes, that's 2.28 million homes. What little is left of U.S. manufacturing is being liquidated as production facilities are quickly being transferred overseas to promote the free trade paradigm. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, Total manufacturing employment in the United States was down to 15.3 million in 2007, from 15.6 million in 2006 and 18.9 million in 2000. The relocation of manufacturing to low-cost plants overseas is what enabled profits to rise and the S&P to grow 65% in the last 5 years. During Greenspan's 1987 to 2005 tenure, the sum of public and private debt in the United States quadrupled from just over $10 trillion to $43 trillion. Whether it's the over $9 trillion of total government debt, which is roughly 64% of U.S. GDP, or the mammoth increase in household debt, which is almost as much as total U.S. GDP and over 130% of disposable income at the national level, Americans are literally swimming in red ink. The main problem, of course, with this development is a basic fact of debt. You have to pay it back. I hold the liquidation thesis. The debt in no way, shape, or form is going to be paid back. It will have to be liquidated, and it is going to be liquidated. And furthermore, the financial service jobs, retail jobs, and food service jobs created by Alan Greenspan credit liquidity are simply going to evaporate. This means that government services of all types and at all levels, federal, state, and municipality, are going to be liquidated. And by necessity, payments like Social Security, disability, housing vouchers, Section 8 assistance, Medicaid, and Medicare assistance of all types liquidated. That's to say, done away with. A run on the U.S. Treasuries has commenced, and also a run on the U.S. dollar has commenced. Both are only a trickle now, but will become a brook, then a stream, then a raging torrent. A financial emergency is coming soon, most likely due to further write-downs of debt by the rating agencies, S&P, Fitch and Moody's, or due to issues surrounding credit default swaps, CDS, or failures of treasury repos or commercial credit not being available to meet the tremendous tidal wave of corporate financing that needs to be done this year that has been accumulating since 2001. When the financial emergency comes, homeowners will be walking away in droves. Well, there you are, ladies and gentlemen. Just a sort of foretaste of things to come. As always, I will be walking you through this bit by bit, hoping to contribute what advice I can, and hoping that that advice is vaguely accurate, at the very least. Just remember what I always tell you about debt, which is to say, eliminate it from your lives. Sell all unnecessary assets. Hunker down and make sure that your outgoings are less than your incomings. So you have at least a hope of making it through this very difficult period without overt hardship. Okay, let me give you my information, please. My name again, Richard Martin. This is Richard Martin's wake-up call. As mentioned before, please call in at any time during the show to 888-873-4643, and you will be put on hold by our engineer, Eric. I will be informed that you are on the line, and I will then take your call at the first available opportunity. Once again, the number, toll-free, 888-873-4643. Now, if you would prefer to send an email, and we do get emails from our listeners with questions that I guess you come up with during the week, that is a good idea to send them by email to me. And then, of course, I will deal with them and give them some kind of an answer at the next talk. And the email address to correspond to is my personal email, which is rmartin@gscorporation.com. Okay, once again, case upper or lower at your own convenience. The word corporation should be written out in full, and please remember that the letters GS stand for Global Strategic, which is Global Strategic Investments of Miami, Florida, where I work. All right, so once more, the email address, rmartin@gscorporation.com. And if you send your emails now, you prefer to send them rather than to call, I will also get them. I have my inbox open, and I will read them out as they come in. Okay, finally, my personal telephone number, if you'd like to call me in private to discuss your individual concerns. Sorry about that, ladies and gentlemen. It appears that we were brutally cut off, and I was in the middle of giving you my personal phone number, so I shall give it again. It is 305-357-5575. Let me do that once again, just give it to you once again, the number, 305-357-5575. That is my personal number. If during the week you wish to call me and discuss any issues that come up for you with me, I would be glad to talk to you about them. Okay, our first caller is Bill in New York. Hello, Bill.
Hello, Richard.
Yes, hi, how are you?
Hi, good, how are you? I missed the very beginning of the show. Were you reading from something?
Reading. I'm sorry. What are you referring to, Bill?
The whole scenario for what's going to happen. Was that a was that printed anywhere, or is that just your thoughts?
That's a basic collation of various ideas that I put together. So I thought I would there's lots more stuff to talk about. I mean, much
sure.
more is going to be happening, obviously. And I particularly didn't want to mention information out of financial sector, because that involves investors and it doesn't necessarily involve everybody who listens to the show. But suffice it to say that everybody is going to get affected by this in whatever capacity. And I might find myself revising some of the ideas that I had as well, because the problem is that the longer this thing goes on, as the Fed and the government paper over the cracks, in other words, just refuse to allow the economy to take the course it's going to take, the more severe it's going to become. I mean, the more devastating this thing will be, because when you have this kind of Ponzi scheme which grows without any justification at all, all you're basically doing by preventing the system from imploding is sucking more people into the vortex. And therefore, people who might otherwise have been relatively unscathed suddenly become massively affected. And I'll give you one example of something which came up the other day from a caller who asked, I think she wrote in on an email, and her question basically was whether real estate, which has not yet gone up so much in price during the bubble, would be likely to fall by equivalent amounts to the kind of amounts that had been mooted as being vulnerable in the coming downturn. And my answer had been at that point that I thought that perhaps they would not be subject to such great declines. However, the proviso being that many people had taken out home equity loans, which made them more vulnerable to having to sell in foreclosure and bankruptcy, thereby pushing the prices down more. Now I'm finding that the situation is so fraught that it is possible that really anywhere you care to name pretty much is going to see drastic reductions in value over the next 3 to 4 years. I kind of revise my opinion on what I thought a few weeks ago, because when the people that you talk to say, oh, I think we've seen the bottom, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about this later on today, but when people say, well, we've hit the bottom, no problem really, everything's going to be okay, it's just a question of ironing out some of the wrinkles here, what they never seem to realize is that as things get worse, they imply worsening situations in other areas which hitherto had not been touched. And that's why, if you can remember back to when the subprime mortgage problem started, everybody was telling you that it was contained. The subprime problem was contained, basically just a subprime area. James Grant had made a joke. He said, yes, indeed, it is contained to planet Earth. Of course, everybody knows what happens next. I mean, one by one, areas of the economy which had not been sort of dinged by the subprime problem got caught up in it. And so people who had simply predicated the problem according to what they saw in front of them were rudely awakened by the continuation of various different things. So I do want you to suppose that things may come up over the next few months or even years that I have not been able to envisage in my own thinking, and that will probably, drastically alter my opinion on various things that I had, not considered to be that much of a risk.
Can I ask you one thing, a follow-up on that? If I understand you correctly, you're saying anybody on Social Security should count on losing it, right? And Medicare also.
Medicare, I think, will be truncated. Whatever advantages you have in Medicare today will be cut down. I think that will happen, yes. And that's not only a function of the coming depression, but a function of the enormous numbers of baby boomers who are going to suddenly flood the system in the next 5 years and ongoing. The system simply won't be able to cope. I don't believe that that will be the case. On other issues, I think that there will have to be cuts. I mean, yes, I don't think that the world can withstand the onslaught that it's about to see. So I think you will see unexpected cuts in all kinds of areas that were not expected. And some of the ones I gave you in the shopping list earlier on represent just a small smattering, I think, of what you're going to be seeing as time goes by. Yeah. Thanks for the call.
Okay. Bye.
Okay, I just wanted to make one quick mention about this ongoing war in Iraq and Afghanistan. As the election draws near, I predict that you're going to hear a lot of people saying that war isn't actually bad for the economy. War stimulates the economy because it involves employment and it involves spending on military hardware that would otherwise not be spent anywhere because there would be no public demand in a time of economic hardship. And therefore, war must be good for the economy because it keeps people at work. Well, some people obviously are going to argue that war is good for the economy, with especially companies like Halliburton or Bechtel or Fluor or Parsons, which are granted contracts to rebuild various stuff the Americans blow up. So obviously would be the case with defense contractors such as Northrop Grumman or McDonnell Douglas and General Dynamics that sort of get to produce an endless cornucopia of spanking new materiel. But let me tell you, ladies and gentlemen, that the idea that wars stimulate the economy is utterly without merit. Let me give you an example. Imagine what we call in England a hooligan. It's a rough kind of youth, a hooligan, basically. You need to learn that word. A hooligan throws a brick through a shopkeeper's window, okay? The shopkeeper is incensed because he will have to pay a glazier a few $100s to fix the window. A crowd of onlookers then try to soothe the shopkeeper, saying things like, think of the glazier, they say. He will take your dollars and buy food for his family, thus providing the grocer with the means to feed his own family, and on and on. Well, it appears that the hooligan, contrary to first impressions, has provided a public service. Without him, who knows how many people might go to bed hungry that night. Well, it's obviously no altruistic comfort to our shopkeeper, however, that his broken window has played such an important role in saving the Republic from financial ruin. and his anger is rekindled when he realizes that the few hundred dollars he will spend on the new window is the money he's been saving for a new suit. So, irrespective of the positive ripple effects of his forced expenditure, the unfortunate shopkeeper is, in the end, a few hundred dollars poorer than he was before the brick came crashing through his window. Prior to the event, he had a window, a few hundred dollars, and the potential of a new suit. Now, he has a broken window, which he can afford to fix, but only if he chooses to wander the streets of his town in his underwear. Well, you know, although the glazier has profited, the shopkeeper, the tailor, and the community at large have suffered losses. Instead of the shopkeeper having both the window and a suit, he must be content with the window or the suit. If we think of the shopkeeper as part of the community has lost a suit that might otherwise have come into being and is just that much poorer. Okay? I think of the families of the soldiers as well, who will be severely thrown into hardship should the soldier either die or become severely disabled. The true cost of the Iraq War is likely to exceed $3 trillion, including the massive costs associated with supporting the tens of thousands of grievously injured soldiers for many decades. This number stands in stark contrast to vastly lower figures the Bush administration has put forth. But it should be remembered that President Bush declared mission accomplished shortly after the war began, so perhaps he has stopped counting. Well, there's a rather crude argument for you, and you know, I think that should lay rather plain why it is that damage of all shapes and sizes really doesn't achieve any economic benefit to mankind. So hopefully you will be disabused of that notion as time goes by, and you'll be able to explain to people less fortunate than yourselves who have not been provided the wherewithal to think straight. All right. Let's deal with a couple of pieces of mail that have come in by email since I last spoke to you. First of all, we have Tracy Green, who says, "Hi, Richard. Since I started listening to you last summer, I've managed to save about $10,000. Are inverse funds still a good investment at this time? Thanks so much for your help. Have a great day, Tracy Green." Answer, Tracy, yes. They are a very good investment at this time. They may be bought into IRA funds and IRA accounts, rather, I should say. And they represent an alternative to selling stocks short. Now, unfortunately, because of the nature of the agreements that we have with what used to be the NASD, which is now FINRA, it's the organization that controls our business, I'm not allowed to give you recommendations over the air, but if anybody wants to know more about this, you're more than welcome to call me. But yes, Tracy, you're on the right track. Now, the other piece of mail I had was, funnily enough, really by strange and extraordinary coincidence, it was a request for a comment on an article which pertained to my Friday talk, which was exclusively about oil speculation and the future trends of oil prices. By strange coincidence, the same article was sent to me by Bill Donovan, who was just on the air just a few moments ago, and also by Cliff. And I will read Cliff's letter first. He says, "Richard, for your show, your radio show, I would like your comment on this article, especially the quote below and the underlined sentences. This is extraordinary if true." Bill says, "Richard, I would like to know what you think of this article." And then Bill then prints out the article. And I appreciate that enormously, Bill, but, you know, this is very, I hope I'm going to have time to read it all. I did read it through very quickly, but I didn't really, I didn't have a chance to really to go into any great depth over it. But I will read, however, what Cliff pasted into his email, some various parts of this article, which I thought were good and very relevant. And for those of you who weren't with me on Friday, I devoted the whole session to a discussion about speculation in oil prices and how the speculators were given pretty much of a bum rap because, you know, we're talking so much about other aspects of what has made oil prices rise that speculation is but a fairly small percentage of the problem. But anyway, I'm going to quote from Cliff's letter, or rather email, and this is what he says. The Commodity Futures and Trading Commission, CFTC, is investigating trading in oil futures to determine whether the surge in prices to record levels is the result of manipulation or fraud. They might want to take a look at wheat, rice, and corn futures while they're at it. The whole thing is a hoax cooked up by the investment banks and hedge funds who are trying to dig their way out of the trillion-dollar mortgage-backed securities mess that they created by turning garbage loans into securities. That scam blew up in their face last August and left them scrounging for handouts from the Federal Reserve. Now the billions of dollars they're getting from the Fed is being diverted into commodities, which is destabilizing the world economy, driving gas prices to the moon, and triggering food riots across the planet. For months, we've been told that the soaring price of oil has been the result of peak oil, fighting in Iraq, attacks on oil facilities in Nigeria, labor problems in Norway, and the all-time favorite, growth in China. It's all baloney. Just like Goldman Sachs' prediction of $200 per barrel, oil is baloney. If oil is about to skyrocket, then why has Goldman Sachs kept a neutral rating on some of its oil holdings like ExxonMobil? Could it be that they know that oil is just another mega inflated equity bubble like housing, corporate bonds, and dot-com stocks that is about to crash to earth as soon as the big players grab a parachute? A conservative calculation is that at least 60% of today's $128 per barrel price of crude oil comes from unregulated future speculation by hedge funds, banks, and financial groups using the London ICE futures and the New York NYMEX futures as exchanges and uncontrolled interbank or over-the-counter trading to avoid scrutiny. U.S. margin rules of the government's Commodity Futures Trading Commission allow speculators to buy a crude oil futures contract on the NYMEX by having to pay only 6% of the value of the contract. At today's price of $128 per barrel, that means a futures trader only has to put up about $8 for every barrel. He borrows the other $120. This extreme leverage of 16 to 1 helps drive prices to wildly unrealistic levels and offset bank losses in subprime and other disasters at the expense of the overall population. Cliff. Well, thanks, Cliff, for that. I'm particularly grateful to you because there are a number of inaccuracies in this article which need to be addressed forthwith. First of all, at the very end there, a futures trader does indeed only have to put up about $8 for every barrel, but he doesn't borrow the other $120. The other $120 never gets transacted. This is just a contract. Now, that's why if you listen to what I said on Friday, then you would understand that these paper contracts do not involve the physical purchase of oil. They only involve contracts which are undertakings to buy or sell oil at a particular price at some future date. So therefore, because they're contracts, there is no borrowing of any $120 or anything else. It is, in many respects, more like a bet. But at the same time, if you are an end user of the oil and you think prices are going to go higher, such as the airlines, for example, then your bet becomes a lifeline, success or failure. Because if you fail to hedge your purchases and the price goes much higher and you can't pass those increased costs on to your consumers, i.e. the flying passengers, then you have a big problem. And there are huge problems in the airline industry today, as I'm sure you all know, and this is one reason why that is the case. The other thing which I wanted just to mention to you was that these contracts are not unregulated, as the article states. They are basically regulated very closely by the CFTC, although it is thought that some hedge funds and financial groups have managed to sort of bypass the hedging conditions by claiming to be, you know, other than what they really are, or using loopholes to climb through. But as I also said to you on Friday, and I don't really want to repeat myself too much here because I really gave a lot of attention to this problem on Friday, speculators need to be as much at ease in a market which goes down as in one which goes up. Because it is very clear to me that we are in a bubble in crude oil at $128 a barrel. And if crude does, in fact, fall to, let's say, $60 or $70 a barrel or even lower, the speculators that bought it up had better get short in the market and sell short the contracts, or else they're going to lose an awful lot of money. So, as I said, speculators are an essential part of a market in that they provide liquidity and pricing stability, and I would not want to discourage them. And I do think that they've been given a bad rap, and I hope that people who heard my show on Friday will be understanding what I'm talking about, and those that didn't might want to go back over the archives, because I gave a fairly in-depth account of, you know, how this whole thing works. So, guys, thank you very much indeed. Let me just take a few things out of Bill's email here, which they talk about the hoax of peak oil having enabled this costly fraud to continue, yet the price climbs relentlessly higher. Why? The answer lies in what are clearly deliberate U.S. government policies that permit the unbridled oil price manipulations. Well, that seems to me over the top. I mean, I don't think the U.S. government is deliberately trying to permit anything at all in terms of price manipulation. Frankly, they're too stupid to even know how to manipulate the oil price. I mean, these people are much dumber, Bill, than the article gives credit for. So I wouldn't be worried about that particularly. But I would like to add a couple of statistics here, which comes in the same article, which tell me, you know, that we're looking at much decreased demand for oil. The U.S. government's Energy Information Administration, in its most recent monthly short-term energy outlook report, by the way, I'm quoting from the article here, concluded that U.S. oil demand is expected to decline by 190,000 barrels per day in 2008. Mainly owing to the deepening economic recession. That means that the key oil-consuming nation, the USA, is experiencing a significant drop in demand. So the world's largest oil consumer faces a sharp decline in consumption, a decline that will worsen as the housing and related economic effects of the U.S. securitization crisis in finance deleverages. Saudi Arabia is, and now I'm talking about the and I mentioned this again too, but here's something else that I thought you'd like to hear from this article, namely elements pertaining to the increased supply of oil over the next few years. Saudi Arabia is finalizing plans to boost drilling activity by a third and increase investments by 40%. In April this year, the Khor Saniyah oil field in Saudi Arabia began pumping and will soon add another 500,000 barrels per day to world oil supply of high-grade Arabian crude. The Corallis oil development is the largest of Saudi Aramco projects that will boost the production capacity of Saudi oil fields from 11.3 million barrels per day to 5.0 million barrels per day by 2009. Corallis is planned to add another 1.2 million barrels per day of high-quality Arabian light crude to Saudi Arabia's export capacity. Then in Brazil, Petrobras is in the early phase of exploiting what it estimates are newly confirmed oil reserves offshore in its Tupi field that could be as great or greater than the North Sea. In the United States, aside from rumors that the big oil companies have been deliberately sitting on vast new reserves in Alaska for fear that the prices of recent years would plunge on oversupply, the U.S. Geological Survey recently issued a report that confirmed major new oil reserves in an area called the Bakken, which stretches across North Dakota, Montana, and southeastern Saskatchewan. The USGS estimates up to 3.65 billion barrels of oil in the Bakken. And lastly, a quote here, in the U.S., stockpiles of oil climbed by almost 12 million barrels in April, according to the May 7th EIA monthly report on inventory, up by nearly 33 million barrels since January. These are stockpiles. Hmm? At the same time, MasterCard's May 7th U.S. gasoline report showed that gas demand has fallen by 5.8%. And refiners are reducing their refining rates dramatically to adjust to the falling gasoline demand. They are now running at 85% of capacity, down from 89% a year ago, in a season when production is normally 95%. The refiners today are clearly trying to draw down gasoline inventories to bid gasoline prices up. It's the economy, stupid, to paraphrase Bill Clinton's infamous 1992 election quip to Daddy Bush. It's called economic recession. End of quote. Well, ladies and gentlemen, quite frankly, reading that, if I was a speculator, a wicked speculator, I'd be going into the crude market, selling it short with everything I've got. Because it seems to me that with all this increased supply and decreased demand, the price of oil is ludicrously exaggerated and liable to fall dramatically over the next few months or years. So when prices do fall, ladies and gentlemen, you will be in a position, along with Bill Donovan, who so kindly provided me with that article, to know why that is and why that was and why the price of oil fell. So when people say, no, I couldn't understand, how come the price went up like that and then just went straight back down, you will have the answers. Okay. All right, let me give you my call-in number once again. It is toll-free to the studio, 888-873-4643. Once more, 888-873-4643. Please feel free to call, and I would love to talk to you. I would love to hear you talk to us. In my newly found guise as the great comparer of things versus the 1930s, which I mentioned at the beginning of this show, I thought it would be appropriate to compare elements of the savings and loan crisis of the 1980s with what happened in the 1930s, because it really was considered that the savings and loans crisis was the worst crisis this country had faced since the Great Depression. And, of course, I am now positing that the current crisis will be much worse than the savings and loan crisis, let alone the crisis of the 1930s. Let's do that. Let's compare the current crisis to the 1980s S&L crisis in regards to whether or not this crisis will be worse. By sheer number of failures, I think you can say that the S&L crisis will dwarf what's coming hands down by numbers. You have to look at an analysis of the numbers, and in that, I think you need to be aware of the bank consolidations. For example, I just give you an example here. This is an incomplete list of the former financial institutions that clearly haven't been able to make it and that now comprise what is known as J.P. Morgan. These are the following banks. Bank One, Chase Bank, U.S. Trust, Manufacturers Hanover Trust, Chemical Bank, First Chicago, National Bank of Detroit, First USA, and, of course, the infamous Bear Stearns. Well, these were companies which all of which could have gone out of business had it not been for, the white knight that came to rescue them. So inasmuch as the capitalization of these big banks is so much greater than it was in the past, there is certainly an element of, truth to the idea that these banks would have been saved in the 1930s in an equivalent situation. But then, of course, when the big one came, it was far greater in scope, as we are, as we will see here. You know, look at the Ponzi scheme that this has been over the years. You know, bank books, loans, mark them up in value and show the difference in profits. They've done the same thing, you know, with the phantom book value these deals present when consummated. Over the last few decades, banks have not really made any money. What they have done is to provide a conduit for the Fed to create massive credit. You know, the U.S. money supply is now over 99% debt. And again, I just draw your attention. I just remind you of what I said about the difference between credit and money. Credit being the operative word here, money being what is needed to create what we call inflation, of which we have seen very little actual increase. And I had exhorted you not to confuse inflation with rising prices, because inflation requires the injection of money into the system. That's how I know that all these prices will collapse, because if it's not inflationary, it means that the prices have simply been bid up on the basis of some kind of speculation that we could have all done without, and that will be, you know, replaced by falling prices as demand just disintegrates. And as we speak, of course, this Ponzi scheme is unwinding and the investors continue to be gullible. You know, those that bought Citigroup on its diluted stock offering are now over 20% in the red. You know, the implications are vast. The risk is enormous. The failure of Bear Stearns alone is enough to counterbalance hundreds of what really amounts to branch failures during the S&L crisis. There were, you know, lots more lenders in the state when the S&L crisis struck. So when a bank failed, 40 of its other banks failed on the same day. You know, today there are some huge banks and brokers at risk, and these are really risky deals here, ladies and gentlemen. So take me seriously when I read these out, because this is not just, you know, picking numbers, picking, you know, stocks off a chart, you know, a dartboard. Wachovia, Washington Mutual, Lehman, Citigroup, Morgan Stanley, Merrill Lynch, Countrywide, Key Corp, Fifth Third, and Regions Financial, just a few of financial mammoth organizations that are, in my opinion, at great risk. You know, the list does look ominous, if not preposterous. I mean, 2 years ago, if someone had said that Bear Stearns and Countrywide would fail and that Citigroup, Morgan Stanley, Lehman, and others would need repeated capital infusions from Dubai, Singapore, and China, they would even laugh off the street. Well, looking back at the S&L crisis, I actually don't recall knowing anyone who was directly affected. This mortgage crisis that we have right now, which is, in fact, of course, a credit crisis, runs far deeper. You know, the ridiculous lending standards compounded by consumer greed and Fed micromanagement of interest rates are causing millions of foreclosures. In their wake, the tens of thousands of self-employed real estate agents haven't had any income for months on end. The originations to securitized model is dying, and mortgage rates are not dropping in spite of massive rate cuts by the Fed. I believe that unemployment is poised to soar, and this means that more foreclosures are going to be forthcoming. REOs are piling up on bank books. What was largely an institutional crisis in the 1980s is now a huge consumer crisis as well as a huge institutional crisis. You see, in the 1980s, the consumer was not tapped out. Today's consumer is so tapped out that many are just walking away from their homes. Others are voluntarily choosing bankruptcy. The Fed can add liquidity now, but it cannot dictate where it goes. This poses a huge problem for the serial bubble blowers at the Fed, because from a jobs creation standpoint, housing was the bubble of last resort. So you see, no matter what the Fed does now, it's not going to spur jobs creation. Furthermore, what was a U.S. crisis in the 1980s is now a global problem. Boomers are entering retirement en masse, and many have been counting on increases in the value of their homes and the stock market to see them through. What boomers need is one thing. What they're going to get is another. And then, you know, we have the Fed finally facing additional problems of a falling dollar, global wage arbitrage, and then an economy at the mercy of hundreds of trillions of dollars worth of derivatives with suspect counterparties. Those derivatives dwarf the entire world's economy. This is all happening at a time when the world is increasingly less dependent on the U.S. and is therefore likely to bend to every whim of the Fed. Well, ladies and gentlemen, the root cause of this mess is the Fed itself, together with the fractional reserve lending that we've all sort of been subjected to over the years. The Fed created this mess with the help from Congress. Well, if you prefer, Congress created this problem by creating the Fed. But whichever way you prefer it, the Fed, and especially Bernanke, are not going to fix it. Instead, they are going to attempt to increase their power, disguised as a need for still more regulation. You know, it's very frustrating for the likes of us who can see what's happening and would really like to deal with it. But, you know, what can you do? A question has just come in from Ralph M., who says, Martin, how can we short oil if we have a regular brokerage account or any other commodities? Well, you can short oil, Ralph, if you really want to, by opening up an account with a commodities broker. A commodity which deals with the retail public in oil, or just about any commodities. All of them deal with all the commodities. So if you find one that deals in oil, it'll deal with any other commodities of your choice. So that's the way to do it. Just open up, just find a broker that deals in commodities, open an account, put some money in, and off you go. Bob's your uncle, as we say in my part of the world. Okay, right, well, we have 5 more minutes here. I think that I will basically give you a quick insight into why it is that people who are increasingly yelling at you with exhortations to buy, 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 because the bottom is behind us, that things are turning up, that the oil is going to collapse, and therefore the stock market is going to soar. You know, why they're really all wrong. I feel that, again, this is another example of, you know, not believing what you hear or being very cautious about what you believe, and because you really need to examine the source. Here's something from the latest FDIC quarterly banking profile released last week, which the one in question here is probably the most dismal report that's come out since the early 1990s. You know, among the highlights here, they say, and I quote, industry earnings for the fourth quarter of 2007 were previously reported as $5.8 billion, but sizable restatements by a few institutions caused fourth quarter net income to decline to $646 million. Now, note what the FDIC is saying here. The banking industry reported $5.8 billion in earnings to its investors, but restatements took that total down by 89%. Well, stop and think about that. Only 11% of the earnings that were reported to investors survived after the restatements. And yet investors seem naively willing to take recent earnings reports, guidance, and charge-off levels at face value as if these reports could be trusted. Well, you know, I'm not going to go into details about how that figure came to be in the first place or how the discount came to made available, because it's a little bit complicated. You know, we need to talk about non-current loan growth, annualized net charge-off rates and things like that, which probably really we don't need to go into here. But the point that I need to make, you know, is that, and you need to really understand this, when you are told statistics that are made available in support of some kind of crazy point of view, remember, please, ladies and gentlemen, the chances are very high that those statistics have been massaged, to put it nicely, and that you should probably take them with a grain of salt. Okay? We've got a couple more minutes here. Let me just basically give you a rather incredible sum here, the aggregate amount of lost home value, assuming a conservative home price recession that sets prices back to roughly what they were in 2003, the loss on mortgage debt levels is 12 minus 7.8, which is $3.2 trillion. But what is really stunning is that if a price pullback to 2000 prices materializes, the loss becomes 12 less 5.5, $6.5 trillion. Mortgage debt losses look like they're going to be over $8 trillion. You know, if national home prices drop by 20%, the total value of mortgage debt losses is minus $3.2 trillion, which means, on aggregate, U.S. mortgage holders may be underwater by $3.2 trillion. Because not only have home prices dropped by 20%, but there were many new homes added to the market. If there was ever a big concern over the number of home buyers walking away from their mortgages, then I think $3.2 trillion suggests a lot are likely to be walking away. If the drop is 30% or 40% or 50%, that would mean a drop in aggregate residential home values by over $8 trillion. And to put that in perspective, the entire U.S. GDP for one full year is only $11 trillion. The global GDP for one year is about $50 trillion. All this really means that the U.S. taxpayers will end up bailing out everyone, including Fannie Mae, and also, by the way, the U.S. Federal Reserve. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we've come to an end of yet another hopefully interesting hour with you, and I look forward to talking to you again on Friday. This is Richard Martin from Richard Martin's Wake Up Call, wishing you a very happy week, and see you soon. Bye-bye.
Radio Network.
From Consumer Reports, exterior paints and stains. I'm Ernie Sprantz. You could spend several dollars more per gallon for exterior paint and stain this year, thanks in part to the pricier petroleum that goes into them. This might tempt you to pick a lesser grade coating, but Consumer Reports tests show penny pinching could cost you more over time. For our June issue, we tested more than 40 paints and stains and include results for major brands after a year or two of accelerated outdoor testing, equal to about 3 to 6 years on a house. Those that scored highest should give you a finish that still looks good after roughly 9 years, assuming they're applied correctly. California brand paints have long been top performers, and the 2010 line is no exception. Its flat paint is top rated and sells for $38 a gallon. Kelly Moore, another regional brand, is also at the top of this year's ratings of fully tested paint.